This is a really hard conversation to have, but this is what we do on the Midday Show. It centers on questions about representation, privilege, and journalistic standards. Earlier this month, Sally Kohns published a book titled The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. Kohns, a liberal political commentator on CNN. Before that, she worked on Fox News. Right after the book came out, she was criticized for how she quoted two black women, Aminatou Sow and Ijeoma Olowu. Now, Sow is a co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. Sow made the case she was not told that she would be quoted in the book until shortly before publication, and that she doesn't actually remember saying what Kohn attributes to her. Now, here's one of the lines in question. Quote, "Once you're provoked, the rules of engagement change," and this is what Kohn attributes to Sow, "and I can effing kill you, and I'm justified in doing that." The other author in question is Ijeoma Olowu. A few years back, on Martin Luther King Day, she responded to some of her racist Twitter trolls and ultimately got an apology from one of them. Olowu criticized Kohn for creating a false dichotomy between her and Sow. Olowu is being held up as someone who takes the high road in the face of bigotry. Sow, on the other hand, believes she's being painted as this stereotypically militant, take-no-prisoners black woman. To be clear, Kohn has apologized in many contexts, but again, at stake here are questions about representation, privilege, and journalistic standards. Ijeoma Olowu is here with us today. She is the author of So You Want to Talk About Race and editor-at-large at The Establishment. She's joined by Rebecca Carroll here in the studio, who is not only editor of special projects here at WNYC, she's also a critic and author. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Aminatou Sow is not able to join us today, but she did send us a recorded statement. Here it is in part.
All of this goes back to privilege, in a sense, where this author felt that she could use the words of a black woman without really checking with her or interviewing her. I think, honestly, that if Sally had talked to more black women for her book, not just me, the so-called imaginary friend, it would probably made her book and her thesis a lot stronger, because she's claimed to me an email, and I have all of these emails, that she, you know, that quote is the moral anchor of the book. Interestingly enough, she never comes back to that quote that is the moral anchor of her book. But she never acknowledges then that, you know, that quote is doing all of the work for this point that she's supposedly trying to make. I think people should read the book and decide that for themselves. But to this question of this incident, the way that she has comported herself before and after to me are, a completely baffling. I really struggle to see a black woman acting in the same way, having her work challenged publicly, and continuing to be on book tour, not giving a sincere apology, and really, really pushing her weight around, in terms of trying to claim that this is true.
We also asked Sally Kohn for a statement. We sent her questions, and while she did not answer all of our questions, her representative just emailed us to clarify 2 points. Number one, and this is a quote, "Sally apologized privately to Amina for weeks and asked if she could speak to her directly. Amina declined." There's another quote. "Sally also reached out to Rebecca," my colleague Rebecca Carroll, "to see if she could speak with her about all of this when Rebecca pulled out of their Penn World Voices Festival event. Rebecca also failed to give her that opportunity," unquote. So, Rebecca, since this is just happening right now, what's your response to that?
Well, so let me just preface this by saying that when Penn first reached out to me to do this conversation, and I like Penn and I've done a lot of work with them and respect them, the language that was used in the email request alone sort of was a red flag for me, which was that, we're hosting this event with Sally Kohn and she wants you, not she wondered if you might be available, or she was hoping that you could participate. It was more sort of like this underlying presumption that I would be thrilled and flattered and lucky, which is a hallmark of sort of white feminism, which is that we will be invited, black women will be invited when said white feminists have arrived at the place that they are and would like us to participate. So to answer your question about not failing to give her the opportunity, when I pulled out of the event, I sent a very, very clear statement to her and to Penn about voicing the reason that I had pulled out. And I didn't feel like that there was anything else to say. Her response to me was, let's talk. I would love to get your advice and or feedback. And essentially what she was saying to me was, tell me how not to exploit a black woman. Ooh. By exploiting a black woman, you know? Mm-hmm. So I felt that I had been very clear and that there wasn't more for me to really add to that.
Ijeoma, if we could turn to you. You know, your tweets have been quoted. Can you tell me a little bit more about the project from which these quotes came? And is this act where you responded to these racist trolls, is that indicative of your work overall?
No, actually, it's quite the opposite of my work. And in fact, this wasn't even really, I would say, a project. This was something I did personally for me. So this was an interaction I had on Twitter personally that I never advertised. I didn't post publicly about, I didn't write about. What I was doing on the day, and I think a lot of people, perhaps non-black people, don't understand that a lot of prominent people, black people on Twitter, kind of gear up for Martin Luther King Day, because this is a day when trolls come out in force and actually search for prominent black people on Twitter to harass them and send racist hate. So on a day when we're trying to remember someone very dear to us, we're also gearing up to, be called the N-word 10 times more than usual. And I was kind of tired of doing that. As I geared up for this 3 years ago, I decided that, you know what, I was just going to honor Dr. King's words personally by, when I encountered these people, just sending them his words. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell anyone I was doing it. I wasn't doing this as any experiment. It was like my own, I just wanted to give this day back to him in whatever way I could.
And so you wanted to do that privately, but you did it on social media.
Yes. Well, I wasn't posting. So, the thing about like Twitter, right, is if you're just replying directly to someone, it's really something that kind of only shows up if you're searching that person's page. It wasn't a public post where I was retweeting. I wasn't going, hey, world, look at this. Mm. I was communicating with people on social media, individually, one-on-one. And most of the conversations ended horribly. Most of them, I would send a quote and then just get another racial slur back or get an image of a lynched black body. And this one conversation went longer and ended up, this person ended up telling me that they were a teenager who had lost their mother. And I am a mom of a teenager. and it ended with him apologizing. And this was at the end of a very long day and at the end of a very long and painful conversation.
Was it just you that he was apologizing because he saw you as a full human, or did he change his ways? Is he still a troll to a lot of other people?
I don't know if he changed his ways at all. He just apologized to me. He didn't say, I'm never doing this again. He said, you're nice, and I'm sorry. Hmm. That's it. And this was after about, 4 hours of really painful abuse. And I was stunned a little bit, because every other response I had gotten was, just absolutely filled with hate. And I shared that conversation with friends and friends only. And then it ended up just, getting picked up. Someone shared with another friend and it went viral. I didn't try to promote it. I didn't want to talk about it. And what ended up happening almost immediately was it became actually even more painful, because a lot of people then started reaching out to me and saying, oh, see, this is how you handle racism. Mm. You just keep being nice, without even understanding the fact that, I left the end of the day with a migraine. I had spent 6 hours taking racist abuse. And all I got was, one 15-year-old saying, I'm sorry.
So is this indicative of your stance of how people of color should address racism?
Not at all. And I don't even, and I think that history shows that this is not how people of color should address racism. The truth is that racism doesn't exist because people of color aren't taking abuse well enough. You know? And there is no amount after 400 years of racial oppression, of abuse that we can take, or, you know, or polite ways we can ask before racial oppression magically lifts, or before racists tire of their racism. And I work hard to, you know, reinforce the fundamental truth that we are human beings, and we are, you know, worthy of dignity. And you can't do that while also saying, let me withstand abuse in the hopes that you'll see that I don't deserve abuse. And that would be, you know, that's the antithesis of what we tell anyone in an abusive relationship or an abusive situation. We don't say, just stay there long enough and they'll stop. They'll see that what they're doing is bad. And I'm trying to get people to understand that our humanity isn't negotiable. The idea that if we are nice enough, it will go away also reinforces the excuses for why that people come up with for why they dehumanize us, right? If we agree that people of color just, you know, need to, you know, be nicer, withstand more, have more understanding, and then racists will learn, and that responsibility is on us. It also reinforces the idea that because Mike Brown, you know, might have acted inappropriately, or, you know, might have been in some trouble, that he deserved to die. Right? There's a flip side to that argument. The truth is that we are human beings.
So, Ijeoma,
and whether people like us or respect us, it doesn't matter. You know, we are human beings. We deserve to live.
Ijeoma, I'm haunted by two things you said. One, our humanity is not negotiable. And what that Twitter troll told you, you're nice, meaning you, mm-hmm. You're the only one that's nice. I'm sorry, but he didn't apologize to everyone else. I want to stress right now that Cohn did apologize to So. Her clip from Cohn's interview with Kara Swisher on the podcast Decode, here's a clip of that apology.
Privately,
right?
The minute I found out she was upset
mm-hmm.
about the quote, about the context, about mm-hmm. the way she used what, right? That I have done what I could
right.
to apologize and to fix it.
Okay.
So again, look, all I can do, it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes learning lessons, and it
right.
sucks
no,
to learn them
public,
in public.
Right.
And trust me, part of what I want to stand for is that we have to be able to have these conversations
right.
because this is the only way any of us get better and learn.
Right.
And so we have to be able to challenge each other.
Right.
And we have to be able to try to listen
mm-hmm.
and engage, even when it's hard, even when we don't want to, right? And not get, so that, again, that for me is the piece going forward.
So she said that no one likes to learn a lesson in public. Rebecca, you taught her a lesson in public because you publicly didn't go to this event. Would you have changed that? Do you believe that it was necessary to make a public statement by not showing up?
Absolutely. I mean, the stakes are just, it's just too high to not take a stand, whether you're a journalist, a dentist, an author, a cab driver, whatever, and whoever you are. In this political climate, when the president of the United States is doubling down on white supremacy, the stakes are too high to not call out white supremacist behavior. Now, whether or not Sally Cohn believes that she's a white supremacist, she is benefiting, you know, the scaffolding of her book, the luxury of intellectual contemplation, the platform she's been given, the language she purports requires no actual consideration of non-white people. So her apology, you know, the book tour continues. Like, when she says we have to have these difficult conversations, I don't hear anything difficult in that conversation. You know, it's just the language of saying we need to have these conversations without actually having the conversation.
Do you believe that Black women are being made to do most of the work in this conversation?
Oh, absolutely. But we're made to do a lot of and most of the work in far and wide.
Now, Cohn says that she sent an apology, and So actually received a letter, and she read us a portion of the letter that Cohn sent her. Here it is.
The first time that I approached Sally about my concerns with her book, we had a very cordial email exchange, and here is what she said. First, let me say that I am 1,000% sorry and then some, and truly apologize for any hurt, anger, and frustration I've caused. Period. Full stop. Completely. I also apologize for the fact that I'm clearly new at this book writing thing and quoting people thing in general. And so when we talked in the cab and I asked if you were okay with me quoting you, I assumed that was the case. I honestly didn't recheck any of the many, many quotes from people in the book, and that, and may, and I guess maybe that's the right protocol. I honestly didn't know, and or I see your point that in the context of this quote and the meta point in general, and I sure am sorry if you feel like my quoting you is reinforcing a problematic dynamic rather than shining a light on it. I certainly have many blind spots that I can only promise to keep trying to work on. I will say that I think that your quote is one of the most profound in the book and provides an important moral anchor throughout the book. So to my mind, I don't think it could possibly be a more favorable citation. But again, my deep and sincere apologies if I botch this completely. I value your voice and your friendship and certainly don't want to do anything to hurt either. Sally. This is a private email that she sent me, and honestly, this is where a lot of my concerns come from. I understand that there are a lot of like apology buzzwords in here, but a lot of the work of apologizing is fixing the thing that you broke. And what I do not hear in this apology is the way that she is going to make it right. Later down the road, when I got involved with Sally's publisher, I asked for her to tweet out an apology because it was important for me to have an external record that she basically was agreeing that we were disagreeing about what was going on here. And, you know, the internet is forever. Sometimes even Twitter is forever. But it was really important to me that that was out in public because people will experience this book also in a digital way.
It's worthwhile just repeating this quote so we know what we're talking about. The quote is, "Once you provoked, the rules of engagement change, and I can effing kill you, and I'm justified in doing that." Rebecca, you heard this apology letter. What's your response?
Again, there is that moment where she says, "I just want to tell you it's the most favorable quote and powerful. So I'm doing you a favor by including this quote. You should be grateful."
Idioma, what's your reaction?
I would say, first of all, that, you know, she says that she has this apology. And by the way, she has, for whatever attempts at apology she's made towards Mina, I haven't heard a single word from her. So she has not addressed me. It's like I don't exist. She was following me on Twitter, sharing my work. She's very familiar with my work until the day that I said I had a problem with the way that my work was mischaracterized. And then she unfollowed me, and I have not heard a word. She hasn't addressed anything I've had to say. Second of all, this apology was then followed up with really strong insinuations that Amina's been lying. And she's insinuated this multiple times. That's not how an apology works. You don't apologize and then go and say someone's lying. It's duplicitous. And it's an abuse of her privilege and the platform that she has right now as she's promoting this book. And I've listened to multiple interviews where she basically, you know, when she's asked, she keeps saying, "I had permission," even though Amina's saying she didn't. Saying, you know, "She saw me take notes." Amina said she didn't. And then she says, "But I'm not going to be put in a position to call her a liar." Well, she is. And really all this is it's just kind of more manipulation of Amina and more, you know, it's really kind of gross and disingenuous to say that she has apologized. You can't really apologize for doing something wrong and then on the other side of your mouth call that person a liar multiple times.
So when is an apology enough, ladies? What kind of apology would you want?
Well, I'm of the mind, I mean, because we're of this era of the celebrity apology. You know, somebody messes up and says something that's racially insensitive or misogynistic or whatever the case may be and issues a statement, heartfelt or not, full of repentance. And then it's over, right? The apology is out there and then that person feels that they have been accountable. I'm here for real consequences. I'm about real consequences and accountability. So to me, an apology is fine, although, as Ishioma pointed out, you can't apologize on one hand and then on the other hand say, "But also you're a liar." But I'm talking about like something that it actually is that difficult, that speaks to this notion of difficult conversations, that speaks to this notion of actual disruption in privilege. And so, you know, it's not up to me or Ishioma to decide or what that looks like, but I do feel like it has to go past an apology.
Pass an apology. So on a Twitter thread that you said this is glaring evidence of how whiteness works. Can you expand on that, Rebecca?
Yeah, I mean, it's peak privilege when you can go about the success and of your endeavor without actually thinking about non-white people. This is the collateral damage of sort of well-meaning white liberals and the fundamental disrespect of black women, our words and our worth.
Here's a clip of Cohen addressing her own privilege on the podcast AMDM by BuzzFeed News.
All I can do is say I have literally no interest in maligning Amina. I showed Amina the quote in the book because I thought it was such an important and great quote and was glad I used it and glad of the point it made in the book, which, by the way, was criticizing me and checking and challenging me on my privilege as a white person.
So, Ijeoma, in a Facebook post about this issue, you wrote that the fact that I'm even being heard is in large part a function of my privilege. How are you privileged?
I'm privileged in a couple of ways. One, I'm a light-skinned black woman. And I have definitely noticed, and I notice almost every day, that the things I say about race are received better than they are received by darker-skinned black people. And there's a lot of studies that back up that, you know, people will view lighter-skinned black people as less threatening or less aggressive. Two, I have the privilege of a college education and am able to write and speak in a way that oftentimes white America finds more favorable, more comfortable. And all of these things kind of combine with my talent and my skill to give me a platform where other people who definitely deserve to be heard and have a lot to say would not. And I'm always aware of that. I'm aware of the fact that, and you know, I'm abled, I'm cisgender. Like, there are so many different parts of my identity that make me more comfortable to the powers that be when I'm discussing these issues than a lot of other people who are also at the crosshairs of these issues would be. And I always have to be aware of that when I'm writing and speaking, that I don't just speak for myself. And that if I'm not aware of who else is out there and who else is being impacted by my words, I can be contributing to the problem as well.
Thank you, ladies. We're going to take a brief break. If you're just joining us, I am speaking with Ijeoma Olowu, editor-at-large at The Establishment, and Rebecca Carroll, editor of special projects here at WNYC. She's a critic and an author. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back. We're talking about journalistic standards, black women, and quotations that are troubling. With me are Rebecca Carroll and Ijeoma Olowu, editor-at-large at The Establishment. Ladies, you are both published authors. You have dealt with vetting quotes in your own work. Is there an industry standard, or does the burden largely fall on the author? Rebecca?
In my experience, because all of my books up until now are, in fact, based on what people are saying, they're interview-based books. I mean, the vetting is very diligent, both for me and for my editors, my publishers. And in my own, you know, essays and opinion pieces, you know, I don't think I've ever quoted anybody without actually checking with them. So, and most of the editors that I've worked with as well have been very diligent.
What about you, Ijeoma? Have you ever quoted anyone without asking their permission?
I have definitely quoted public work, and I've definitely quoted, like, the president, you know, things like that. I would say there isn't really a standard as far as, I mean, you have a duty to be accurate, and there's usually a standard of, like, if you're having a conversation with someone personally, and you're going to quote them and use their name to let them know. That's the general practice, and ask their permission. And I definitely did that. So when it was someone, you know, a human being that I had talked to or had, you know, shared a story with me, I definitely rechecked that they were okay with me using it and let them know the context with which it was going to be used. For me, my problem here is not even necessarily that, you know, I was put in her book without permission. It's the fact that Sally Cohn is very aware of my work and my stance on this. And so this was really, in my opinion, a willful miscategorization of my work to suit her purpose.
How do you believe it was categorized? How do you believe that you were categorized?
So I was definitely categorized as the antithesis of so. I was the person modeling, you know, extreme empathy and patience and she literally ends that chapter saying, you know, we could all do well to be more like Ijoma.
So much like that Twitter troll, you are the nice one. Much like that Twitter troll, you are the nice one.
Yes.
I see.
And it was really, and even saying, you know, I prefer Ijoma's approach. This is not my approach. And she knows this because she's been following my work and sharing my work. And anyone who could do a cursory search of my work knows that that's not my approach. And so that's really where I have the issue, is because she's positioning herself as an ally who's on our side, who has ideas about, you know, what can help solve this situation that's literally killing Black Americans. And then in the process of making a statement that I would never make, she also makes it mine, makes me an example for a position I'm firmly against, and then says, you know, we should all be more like her. That's the issue I have. It's really about the morals behind the decision. It's really about, you know, if you have the privilege to have a book and you're trying to write about a situation you're not living anyways, because she has never once in her life been a Black woman, and you decide you're going to write about how you feel that Black women should be handling racist hate, which I have questions about anyways, to then mischaracterize a Black woman in that process, it's just abusive.
It's just abusive. I want to remind anyone who's joining us right now about the quote in question that is, according to the author, opposite of what you think. This quote is, "Once you're provoked, the rules of engagement change, and I can effing kill you, and I'm justified in doing that." Now, Cohn herself believes that her methods are in line with journalistic standards. Here's a clip of her explaining this on AMDM by BuzzFeed News.
Let's be clear. I'm not inventing a new standard of book writing here, right? And it's false to say that the book wasn't fact-checked. It's false to say that the quotes weren't checked. They were. Sure. They're checked against the notes. But I just want to be clear, again, we're at a moment in this country. This does not excuse any of the dynamics, my blind spots, my bias. I take full account for that. Let's separate this and not sully the waters and further pile on to the attacks of journalists. Like when journalists, you know, and this, and I, this happens to journalists, right? Mm-hmm. Where sources say something, it gets printed, and then they say that they didn't say it. Well, that's why you have institutions that we believe in that look at the notes that verify that people said what they said. But let's not like make this a bigger attack on institution of journalists, journalism, and writers. This is the standard.
What do you think?
Yeah, I just want to say, you mentioned the contradictions in that statement. First, towards the end of that quote, she says, you know, this happens to journalists, you know, sources say something and then they say they don't say something. Well, in the book, Amina is a friend. She's not a source. So for her to go from a friend to a source in this narrative on in this interview that suits Cohn is troubling. The other thing is that she it suddenly becomes a conversation about an assault on journalism, when in fact in her first email to Amina she said, "I'm new at this book writing thing." You know, so the shift of the narrative to suit herself is deeply troubling.
I want to listen to another clip here from So's statement. In it, she explains how she feels that the quote itself will remain in all future versions of this book, but it will no longer be attributed to the woman in question, and instead will just be attributed to an anonymous friend. Listen to this.
I don't believe that Sally has proven that she got that quote from me, or that she did it in real time. And, you know, and I'm curious if there is another friend that she thinks that this is, and she is attributing it to me. But again, it's not just about the quote. It is about everything else that is going on here. We are not friends. She gets my occupation wrong, and she gets the location of this conversation wrong as well. It seems like a very small thing, but honestly, at this point, there's a lot going on.
Ijeoma, are you that friend? Who's that friend now?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure if you had asked Ms. Cohn a month ago, she probably would have said I was that friend. And she was following and sharing and commenting that she liked my selfies, and now literal absolute silence. And I really hope people understand that. She's traveling around everywhere saying she's apologized multiple times and tried to make this right. She hasn't addressed a single point I made about what is so problematic about what she's done. She has not addressed me publicly or privately. I have not heard from her or her team. So that in itself is a lie.
right.
She hasn't tried at all to make this right. And second of all, I would say removing her name, is, you know, after this, doesn't actually undo the damage and undo the fact that she really painted this really stark picture as if the two options for how black people in America are supposed to deal with racist hate are to kill them or take you know, endless amounts of abuse. That's neither of those affirm the humanity of black people. And neither of those are productive when we're talking about systems of oppression. And I really do wish that Ms. Cohn had reached out to black people who have been doing this work for a long time. Because what's actually killing us is not someone thinking that they hate us because of our race. The hate isn't what's killing us. It's the system empowering it. And there's no amount of abuse we can take that lifts that system. And with all of her privilege and all of the audience and all of the money and publicity around this book, Ms. Cohn could have been doing some real work to talk about these systems that are killing us. But instead, what she did was she wrote a narrative that puts even more work on us while we're battling the hate and battling the systems. And she can remove her, you know, Ms. Cohn's name. She can remove Ms. So's name. She can remove my name. And it's still going to do harm to the black community. And yeah, I do take personal offense in that I was mischaracterized in order to help do that harm. But the harm won't be lifted if she changes some names. And that's a fundamental issue about her privilege here, is that she really thought she could write about this without actually reaching out to the people who are living it.
Rebecca?
Yeah, I keep returning to, like, you know, this quote and, you know, removing Amina's name and calling her a friend, in some ways to me is almost worse, because she was never a friend. And now she's some, you know, this it's attributed to some, random black woman who's saying, again, something that is really, you know, stereotypically problematic and violent and invokes this notion of this angry black woman. And in some ways it reminds me, like, what is it about that quote that is so critically important to her narrative? It reminds me of white people needing to say the N-word. It's like, why do you feel like you have to? Like, this black woman has said to you, I don't remember saying that. I didn't say that. You didn't check with me. I am not your friend. You got my job ID wrong. Take the quote out. You can't have it.
You cannot have it. Now, on the subject of anonymous attribution, Ijeoma, Sally Cohn cites Susan Benesch's research as how she came to your tweets. We looked through the Benesch's papers, which she wrote along with Lucas Wright, Derek Roos, Kelly P. Dillon, and Haji Mohammed Salem, and it was titled Vectors for Counter Speech on Twitter. There's actually a footnote in the paper that says, quote, we've erred on the side of not revealing the identities of people in the cases we described in order to protect them and to preserve their privacy. We've made exceptions, however, for public figures and or those who have already chosen to discuss this case publicly. Now, they chose to keep you anonymous in the paper. How do you feel about that decision?
I'm actually fine with how that instance was used in the paper, because I think it's really important to understand. I think actually Ms. Cohn mischaracterized that paper in her book as well, because the paper itself wasn't a diagnostic, right? It wasn't saying this is how you should respond. What it was actually just kind of a listing of the different types of counter speech that they found on the internet.
Thank you so much.
Was one example.
We're running out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Ijeoma Olowu, editor-at-large at The Establishment, and Rebecca Carroll, WNYC editor for Special Projects.